A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everybody, and welcome back to another year of the Explaining History podcast. Thanks very much, and I apologise, I've been away for a few days, or a couple of weeks in point of fact, so there hasn't been any podcast updates over Christmas, but we're going to really get back into it with some exciting new stuff now in the new year. Okay, so before we get started on today's podcast, a few little bits of info for you. Firstly, you can check out my new guest blog in the Huffington Post. Look for Nick Shepley under Huffington Post UK. I'll be talking about history, teaching, and a few other things that I'm involved in. There is also a monthly review podcast we've got finalised with IB Tourists, our kind donator of books, and just so you know, in the interests of transparency, they are not donating me any money, which is, you know, a bad thing, but hey. This is going to start at the end of this month, hopefully with a review of some British history titles. So we're going to be looking at some British history in a moment. On the thorny topic of money, we are a pay-as-you-feel service here at Explaining History, so the content is all absolutely free in every regard and independent of anyone else, but donations would help the annual running of the podcast immensely. There have been some incredibly kind and generous people who've donated in the past, but obviously anybody who is able to help with the cost of hosting particularly, we'd love to hear from you, and you can drop me a line at info@explaininghistory.com if you're able to contribute anything, but if not, don't worry about it, just enjoy the podcast. Anyway, the thing that I want to talk today about is a really curious period of time in Britain, from the mid-70s really up to the end of the 1980s, and it's the relationship between pop music and radical politics, and how the two come to be entwined. Now, the moment of radicalisation of pop music, particularly in the 1970s, was brought about by alcoholic blues legend Eric Clapton. It's a moment that's gone down in British pop culture history, but it has a significant subtext, a significant backdrop to it. In August 1976, on the 5th of August, at the Birmingham Odeon, Clapton came on stage drunk and began a lengthy tirade against black people and other immigrants into the UK. He reeled off all sorts of horrendous racist language that I won't repeat here, though, you know, you can find the full transcript of what he said. He essentially said that he was emigrating, and that Enoch Powell had been, who had obviously been the key political figure in Birmingham some 8 years previously. He made his inflammatory "Rivers of Blood" speech, that he claimed that Enoch Powell was a visionary and a man who should be listened to. Now, it was this moment that galvanized activists to write to that bastion of music taste and analysis, the New Music Express, the NME, and to demand that action was taken against racism in music. Now, you've got to imagine the context of British race relations in the mid-1970s. I mean, had there been had there not been a far-right movement in the 70s, had there not been violence against black and Asian people in the 70s, then what Clapton had to say would probably have been forgotten. But the bigger contextual picture was the rise of the National Front in Britain, the fascist organisation that kind of eventually morphed into what nowadays is the British National Party, many of whose members have now joined UKIP. The period of economic crisis that Britain had been undergoing since the mid-1960s, as the world economy slowed down, and certainly went into crisis after the oil crisis in 1973. But Britain had been underperforming due to low investment, poor management, desperately bad industrial relations, and the progressive relative economic decline that had been ongoing since really the 1950s. This all created a backdrop for racial violence and racial tensions as immigrants from the former empire were now being blamed for the rising unemployment of the 1970s. Of course, they had nothing to do with it whatsoever, and in fact, their immigration to Britain had been actively encouraged, indeed, by Enoch Powell himself, who believed that the transport network would be ably served by black and Asian immigrants, while obviously white workers would do far superior work, in his view. So there is a kind of a mixture of factors that meet in the mid-1970s that fuel racial tensions, racial animosities, and the far right. And you see, really, what you're seeing really is this kind of embattled and threatened white working class that's really been threatened not by black and Asian people and their perceived ability to work for lower wages, but by the forces of really of globalisation that are impinging on Britain. Britain had continued after the end of the Second World War to consider herself a country that was really above these considerations, or one that could indefinitely go on with high state spending, a declining economy, and large expensive overseas commitments, and not wind up facing economic crises such as the devaluation or the IMF bailout that happens in 1976. And it's this kind of shuddering realization that Britain isn't immune to the cold winds of global recession, and that Britain isn't as she was 100 years beforehand. It was a freelance photographer for the Sunday Times, Red Saunders, who first wrote into the NME and demanded that something be done, and received quite an enormous response, and founded a group called Rock Against Racism. This was in 76, just at the beginning of punk, one of the first and most significant contributors to Rock Against Racism, a relatively unknown group at the time, but soon to reach global superstardom, was The Clash. The interesting thing about this, and the reason why I'm talking about it, and it's not a sort of a small and irrelevant historical footnote, is the combination of Rock Against Racism and then a year later the development in 1977 of the Anti-Nazi League became a mass movement in Great Britain. In 1978, 80,000 people met at Trafalgar Square, for example, to protest against the rise of the far right. If you imagine that in 1936 at the Battle of Cable Street, you're looking at roughly an equivalent number of protesters, something about 100,000, official statistics vary. There are interesting in numbers alone certain parallels. When in his history on the subject, Dominic Sandbrook wrote about the Anti-Nazi League and particularly its associations with the Socialist Worker Party, he argued that the Anti-Nazi League were really attempting to emulate the great and glorious Battle of Cable Street, when Oswald Mosley's black shirts were chased off the streets by anti-fascist protesters. Whether this is the case or not, I don't know. However, obviously it's difficult to emulate such things because you're existing in very different historical circumstances. Oswald Mosley, of course, was marching through the Jewish East End of London at the same time that Hitler was passing anti-Semitic laws in Germany. So it is a really very different set of affairs to the events as anti-Nazi street battles in 1978, against the National Front, who fascism in 1978. Has nowhere near the power and significance it has in Europe in 1936. But of course, with all these movements, they're always wrapped up with a high degree of romanticism, and that's perhaps to be slightly expected. Rock Against Racism, as the late 70s progressed, becomes interested in a variety of issues, such as the ongoing involvement of Great Britain in Northern Ireland during the Troubles in Northern Ireland, the apartheid regime in South Africa, and the civil war in Rhodesia, then Zimbabwe, and the finally the whole political scene on the anti-racist radical left is turned on its head by the emergence in 1979 of Margaret Thatcher. Now, you can safely say about Margaret Thatcher, irrespective of where you stand on the subject of her legacy, she's nothing if not polarising. And for the Anti-Nazi League and Rock Against Racism and the fellow travellers of that movement, their politics spread out really from being single-issue campaigning over the subject of
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Racism towards a much broader resistance, cultural resistance to the monetarist and neoliberal economic and social policies of Margaret Thatcher. Throughout the movement, a broad sense of tolerance of a whole range of different lifestyles, questions of class, gender, race, and sexuality are brought up. I mean, one good example of that would be the Tom Robinson band and their Tom Robinson's anthem, "Sing If You're Glad to Be Gay," which was the first song which they explicitly discussed homosexuality in any positive light at all. It's interesting, from then on, you get throughout the 1980s, you get a generation of artists who are able to be kind of openly gay. Many of them on the left, for example, the Communards and Jimmy Somerville. And for a decade which was not marked by its tolerant attitudes towards sexuality, you do get this profusion of pop acts and performers that explicitly talk about it and do it very well and sell an awful lot of records. Now, one of my Christmas reads, and the reason I'm talking about this, has been Daniel Rachel's Walls Come Tumbling Down, which is a fascinating book on this entire period. And one of the things that he argues is that for the first time ever, the mixture of pop and politics comes together, that this hadn't really existed in British popular culture beforehand. By and large, I think this is valid. I've talked before on this podcast about John Lennon in the early 70s and his attempts at social activism. But most of that was done in America. It was fairly short-lived, and it was not really emulated by anyone else in any high-profile or meaningful way across the industry. You have a far greater incidence of activism in America throughout the 1960s, kind of petering out in the 1970s as the hippie moment dies. But the anti-racist movement that morphs into a kind of a more broader left association between pop music and politics really emerges in this particular time period. Now, one thing to talk about when we're talking about pop and politics in the 1980s is obviously Live Aid. Live Aid presented itself, I suppose, really as a kind of a largely non-partisan event. You have, for example, prominent Tories such as Phil Collins, and of course Queen appearing at the event. So it was hardly a kind of a meeting of the radical left, but there was, obviously, from Bob Geldof, implicit criticism of Margaret Thatcher and of the policies of the Thatcher government towards Africa, the Third World, and aid. The extent to which really the audience was in any way politicised is highly doubtful. I mean, as with many of these things, people go along to see a good show, and the global, the sort of the sensation of the sensationalism of having a kind of a global event of this nature, and the use of satellite technology to link up events in America and Great Britain was obviously very novel. The sort of naivety really around aid at that time and about what could be achieved and about how much public altruism in Britain and America and the wealthy world could really bring about meaningful change in countries like Ethiopia was very much of its moment and surrounded by a great deal of ignorance on that. I want to talk actually about Live Aid on its own in greater depth another time. So I'm not going to go too deeply into that one right now. But what I want to talk about in addition to this is the emergence of Red Wedge, which was just the kind of the final thing I'm going to discuss in this podcast. Red Wedge was one of the first explicitly partisan aspects of the kind of the left and British pop music, a coalition of musicians predominantly featuring Billy Bragg, backed the Labour Party in the early to mid 1980s. It was slightly predated by the development in 1979 of the group The Specials. Specials founded in Coventry by Jerry Dammers, who was an explicitly socialist musician and record producer who wanted to create a fusion of black and white music and create a group where both black and white people appeared on the stage. Up until that point, there had been this kind of concern that black and white groups shared the stage, but never together and never united as one. And the Specials were, as a ska band, explicitly meant to be that. The Specials' big hit was Ghost Town, which was a kind of a visceral condemnation of Margaret Thatcher's Britain. It was a protest song against unemployment and the effect of monetarist economic policies on Britain's young people and the kind of spiralling mass unemployment of the early 1980s, which rivaled and even in some instances eclipsed that of the 1930s. So the importance of Ghost Town can't be understated, particularly on the British left. The Falklands War in 1982 and the miners' strike in 1984, again, are two moments where pop music becomes politicised. For example, if you look at the work of Elvis Costello, song Shipbuilding, a protest song which depicts the shipbuilding towns of the northeast of England creating warships in order to go and essentially fight a war for the powers that be. And the work of Billy Bragg as well, that developed really as a result of the miners' strike. And as I mentioned before, Billy Bragg and the lead singer of the former group, The Jam, Paul Weller, were the founding members of Red Wedge, which was a kind of a coalition of artists who were dedicated to ousting Margaret Thatcher from office in the next general election. Red Wedge also was joined by actors and activists, filmmakers, comedians, the radical fringe of 1980s stand-up comics like Alexei Sale and Ben Elton and people like that, who were considered very daring and cutting-edge at the time, to support the Labour Party in the 1987 general election. In 1987, Red Wedge conducted tours of marginal constituencies, headlining small town halls and local working men's clubs and things like that with musicians, comedians and filmmakers and actors and the great and the good of the kind of the British cultural left. But it's what happened after the election that really matters, sadly. The Conservative Party were returned on a massive mandate. The most austere aspects of monetarism were being abandoned by the mid-1980s by Nigel Lawson, who generated a huge and ultimately a sustainable boom. By 1987, there was appeared to be a significant amount more prosperity in the country. And when Labour were defeated again, not all of the lessons of Red Wedge were abandoned or ignored. In fact, a new young PR director for the party, Peter Mandelson, saw the degree of cultural engagement that people like Paul Weller and Billy Bragg had brought about for Labour, and saw that there was something really quite valuable in it. Mandelson was happy to abandon the politics and follow a broadly similar economic model to Margaret Thatcher. But 10 years later, when it was Labour's moment to sweep to power in 1997, embracing all aspects of cultural policy and embracing fellow traveller musicians, the likes of Damon Albarn or Noel Gallagher or whoever else you could get into number 10 for Champagne and Canapes, but not politics, was a key part of Labour strategy. So much so that on the eve of the next general election, the Labour Party approached the author J.K. Rowling, author of Harry Potter, and actually asked, amazingly, whether Harry Potter would become a new Labour mascot, whether they could own the rights to Harry Potter. So that shows you how far politics had gone by the end of the millennium in terms of seriousness, shall we say. Okay, well, I've gone on for long enough. Walls Come Tumbling Down is a great read. I entirely recommend it. And the reason, again, why, is because it helps to fill in this really interesting and little understood period in British political and cultural history when ordinary people, far from the kind of the megastars of the music industry, your Freddie Mercury's, your David Bowie's, aren't really getting involved in this one. Fairly ordinary people took responsibility to unite and organise against racism in Great Britain, albeit with mixed results. Anyway, look forward to speaking to catching you all on the next Explaining History podcast, and I hope you all had a great Christmas and New Year, and here's to hopefully a trauma-free 2017. Take care.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.